Chapter 10. Sarah fills me in on where she's been since she was taken from Paradise. She glosses over being imprisoned in Dulce. It kills me to think they might have tortured her or something, but I don't push the issue because how do you casually ask, "So, what terrible things happened to you when the FBI threw you in a secret dungeon?" She goes into more detail about everything after that, though, and walks me through the escape from New Mexico, their time at the John Hancock Center in Chicago, which I was totally right about being a Mogatak, and then their temporary hideout in Maryland, where she finally got the emails I'd been sending her. She tells me about a team of guard sent down to Florida, and my head buzzes as I think of all the weird messages that have been sent to me about gangs in the Everglades and kids with telekinetic powers. One of the guard died down there, and when she left John and the others, none of them even knew which one it was. Shit is getting very real on Earth. The more we talk, the more puzzle pieces start to fit together. A bigger story forms. Notes and small leads start to connect, and I suddenly have information about people and places that I was just kind of guessing at before. I learn names like Cetricus Ra and Adam, and that there's a giant Moog base somewhere up in West Virginia, and that the Moogs have been doing all sorts of experiments with some of the dead guard and alien animals. Not that this is really any surprise, considering the crazy-ass stuff they've been doing to Bud Sanderson. I type notes on one of the computers in the hidden room as fast as I can, trying to keep up with her as she talks. "This stuff is incredible," I say. "I never could have uncovered all this on my own. What's your plan, Mark?" She stares at the security monitors on the wall. Sarah's still trying to wrap her head around the fact that I'm hiding out in some kind of spy base. Over her shoulder, I see BK travel across the monitors, a pet from another planet helping to make sure our perimeter is secure. I pause. I've been going full throttle, alone, trying to absorb everything. I haven't really had to put into words what my mission or whatever is. "We tell the world what's really happening," I say, choosing my words carefully. "We wake them up and get them on our side." Sarah smiles at me strangely, as if she wasn't expecting something like that to come out of my mouth. "Next time I talk to John, I'll see what kind of evidence he can send our way." As we work, I tell her about breaking into Sam's house and finding all the old newsletters, stealing Purdy's computer and my road trip across the country, first looking for her and then following guard's orders to Alabama. She listens carefully as I talk, her face twisting and lighting up as she calls me lucky and stupid and even heroic. Mark James Hero. That has a nice ring to it. I'm pretty sure I blush when she says it because afterwards she laughs and rolls her eyes, but it feels good, especially since this is the first time I've really sat and thought about all the different things I've had to do in the last few weeks. I've been so focused on the stuff I failed at, like getting caught in the FBI trap and not being able to contact Sharma or find Sarah, that I'd kind of forgotten that I've totally been living in, like, a James Bond movie lately. With aliens. And I'm 007. John sends us crappy cell phone pics of a bunch of documents he recovered from some FBI agents, including my old friend Agent Walker, who has apparently switched sides completely and is helping out the Lorik, at least for now. I'm happy she let me go, but I can't imagine that I'd trust Walker or her agents with my life or anything. I hope John and the others know what they're doing. I can say that this stuff, combined with some of the other files we've salvaged from Purdy's computers, make for some pretty epic breaking news. I'm talking stuff like photos of Moogs shaking hands with politicians, and lists of who within the government is playing ball with the shark-faced mofos. I practically piss my pants with excitement when Sarah forwards them to me, before I send them along to guard for a second look. A story like this could be big, so we should probably make sure that we don't completely screw it up when we post it. We print out everything and tape it to the walls of the back room, trying to piece together the larger story. This stuff is bigger than all of us. It's the truth, and the world needs to be able to see it. I start working on articles, posts that incorporate all the new info that's suddenly been dumped at my feet. This shit is going to go viral, I tell Sarah. It's definitely going to piss off the Moogs, she says hesitantly. You're sure they can't track us here? Definitely. Guards got this place locked down. He'd better, she says. It sounds like she might have some doubts about this. She's not exactly on team guard and asks a lot of questions about where all the stuff in the safe house came from, how he got a truck to me, anything about his actual personal life that I can't answer because I have no idea who he is. I tell her that she should just trust him and be done with it, but that's not exactly her style, especially with all she's been through. I don't really blame her. I'm not even really sure why I trust in him so much. Maybe it's because after Sarah disappeared, he was the one constant I had. After Sarah's read over the articles, I upload them, and our hit counter on They Walk Among Us skyrockets. My post detailing MoogPro, which it turns out stands for Mogadorian Progress, attracts a lot of attention thanks to the intel John gets out of Walker. Some commentators start guessing that the whole blog is viral marketing for some new sci-fi movie. Other anonymous users send death threats. Views and comments come in from all over the world. So many that I give Sarah the login to my Jolly Roger 182 account so we can split the work of sorting through them. We make a good team. Things are looking up. Until the next day, at least. I wake up from a power nap around dusk feeling a little off. Just weak and a little sick to my stomach. I'm sweating a lot, too, which I brush off as the fact that we're in the South and it's humid as balls. When I get up and start moving, I realize that my left arm is all stiff and sore. And so while I wait for coffee to brew in the kitchen, I pull up my t-shirt sleeve and take a good look at the place where the bullet grazed me. It's not pretty. The wound is swollen and a dark, sort of terrifying red color. It's kind of hot to the touch, too. In short, it looks mad at me for not taking better care of it. Sarah walks into the kitchen while I'm looking at my arm. Holy crap, Mark! It's not that bad, I suggest. No, she shakes her head. That looks terrible. I'll just pour some more rubbing alcohol on it and pick up some super glue and... I have to stop because she looks like she's going to simultaneously puke and smack me. It's infected. We have to do something about it, or it'll get even worse. We've got a lot of work to do. I start for the back room. You could lose your whole arm, Mark, she says, standing in front of me so I can't pass. She puts her hand on my forehead. Jesus, you've got a fever. You could get sepsis. We have to do something. At least let's get some antibacterial stuff. I relent. We could use some more groceries anyway. I grab my keys. Sarah clears her throat, holding out one palm. I'm driving, she says. No way, I say. Suddenly I'm feeling very overprotective of my shiny new truck. And the Sarah I know, or knew in paradise at least, didn't have the best history with oversized vehicles. Mark? Sarah? I say. We lock eyes for a few seconds. I'm okay to drive, I promise. Trust me. She doesn't respond immediately, but finally sighs. Okay, she says. Okay. Huntsville is the big city closest to us, but there are a bunch of little towns between there and the ranch. I try to go to a different one every time I pick up supplies, so this time I drive Sarah towards a place called Moulton, which is tiny but has a Walgreens and a grocery store at least. BK rides in the back, and I roll one of the windows down so he can stick his head out. The sun starts to set in the west. As we drive, we make supply lists out loud. Maybe we could get BK to sneak into the pharmacy section and steal you some penicillin, Sarah suggests, though I'm not sure he can read. I'm pretty sure I'm allergic to penicillin, I say.
You don't know?
I shrug. I'm like 90% positive. She shakes her head. What? I ask. I've been going to the same doctor since I was a baby. He always just prescribed me medicine and I took it.
Give me a list of UN ambassadors, she says.
I don't know where she's going with this, but I start to rattle off the people I've been looking into based on the files we've uncovered. She stops me after a dozen.
You can name all those people, she says, but you don't know if you're allergic to penicillin. If it could kill you. If I didn't know any better, I'd say you've been replaced with a Moog clone since we were in paradise.
She's right. I start to laugh a little at just how absurd this is. How absurd all this is. And she does, too. It's like I haven't laughed in a really long time. And now I have to get it all out of my system while I can. I go into a fit of laughter. And it feels wonderful. So wonderful that I end up running a stop sign. I know this because suddenly there are flashing lights and a motorcycle cop behind me, pulling me off onto a side street in Moulton. Oh, shit, I say. Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit.
You're so fucking stupid, Mark.
What do we do? Sarah asks. She's sitting up straight, her left hand white-knuckled as she grips the console between us.
Please tell me your guard friend gave you a legit fake ID.
No, I shake my head. It's not like I can give the officer my real license. I'm guessing everything with my name on it has been flagged by the FBI. Let me think. I never had to worry about traffic tickets in paradise. Perk of being the sheriff's son. I even talked my way out of a ticket for underage drinking once because this guy Todd, a former Paradise High football player, was the officer who caught me and my buddies with a case of beer out in a cornfield.
But now my life is going to be monumentally screwed up because of a single stupid stop sign.
The officer dismounts from his bike. I pull my sleeve as far down over the wound on my arm as I can, and then tighten my grip around the steering wheel. I might be able to lose him if I speed off while he's up here, I say.
He's on a bike, Mark, Sarah says. You have no idea where you are, do you? He'd catch up to us.
She's right. Of course she is. I glance into the truck's back seat. BK's tail is wagging, but his eyes are darting back and forth between me and Sarah as if he's asking what he should do.
Worst comes to worst. Can BK scare him off?
Sarah just looks at me, shrugging. BK lets out a little whine. I can't even tell if the damned dog can understand me. And then the officer's tapping on the window. License and registration, he says as I roll it down. Yeah, I start. I launch into this whole story about how we're on vacation, hence the Louisiana plates, and we just run up to town to buy a few groceries, and oops, we totally left our IDs and stuff down by the swimming hole at the ranch where we're staying. I actually use the term swimming hole. The officer sighs and asks if the truck is mine. I say it is, and he tells me to stay put while he goes back to his bike. I use the time to take a few deep breaths and try not to completely lose my shit. This is okay, I murmur. Maybe he'll just write me a ticket. I'll give him a fake name. Sarah stares holes through me.
What?
I ask.
Do you want me to make a break for it now? Is this truck stolen?
She raises one eyebrow as she speaks.
No, of course.
I stop talking because it could be. I guess I really have no idea. I look into the side mirrors nervously as the cop strolls back up to my side of the truck. He doesn't seem to be treating us like felons, at least.
All right, he says. The vehicle's not listed as missing or anything. I don't see why I should ruin your vacation with a few tickets. I'm gonna let you off with a warning, but I've reported it. So don't make it a habit of driving around without your license or you'll definitely get a citation next time.
He grins.
Just make sure to watch for those stop signs, son.
I'm so relieved I could vomit.
He starts to walk away, but turns back.
Funny first name, he says. I don't think I've ever heard it before.
Huh? I ask, confused.
From your registration. Jolly, Jolly Roger.
He thinks about this for a second and laughs a little. Meanwhile, my lungs fall into my guts. It's a family name, I mutter. But all I can think about is how he just ran the plates to a truck that turns out to be registered to a guy named Jolly Roger. A truck purchased the morning after a shootout between Jolly Roger 182 and the FBI in the same city, and how at this moment the Moogs are probably slobbering all over themselves to find out who this dickhead is who's unleashing all their secrets on the internet. You're an idiot, Mark. How could you be so stupid as to use that name? You look like you're about to pass out, Sarah says. Are you feeling okay? I swallow hard. Screw supplies. Screw my arm. I think we'd better go back to the ranch. Chapter 11. Sarah tries to tell me that I'm freaking out about this too much, but I can tell she's worried too. She knows the lengths the Moogs will go to in order to get what they want. After all, she was their prisoner. As we drive, she goes into more detail about the rebel Moog John's recruited onto his team. Apparently, he's a hardcore computer whiz, and there are tons of evil ETs who've been trained on computers just like he has. It doesn't bode well for us. I kind of wish I'd known this sooner. I have no way of knowing who'd win in a hacker battle between Guard and a spaceship full of highly trained Moogs. I have Sarah text Guard, telling him what happened, more about Adam, and asking for his advice. She reads and responds for me as I drive us back towards the ranch. Guard, if the Moogs had no idea where you were, they'd never be able to track you down based on your IP address or any of your communications from the ranch. Guard, but if they know you're somewhere near a little town in Alabama, that could be trouble. Me. Shit. What should we do? Guard, that's your call. It should take them a while to pinpoint an area to search. Could take hours, could take weeks. I don't know how skilled their hackers are. Guard, more than likely they'd just raise the whole area looking for you. Me, all my notes and stuff are at the ranch. We need that info, but maybe it'd be better if we just abandoned the base? Can you get all my stuff off the computer? A minute passes. Guard, no, it's either dead or turned off. I can track its location, but I can't get onto it remotely without juice. Not charging my electronics is going to kill me. Sarah looks at me. All the work we've been doing is on your computer, right? She asks. Yeah, but... I start. We can swing by and grab everything. Then, I don't know, find one of those crappy motels you've gotten so good at scouting out. This is dangerous, I say. She laughs a little. You don't have to tell me. She texts Guard back, telling him what we're doing. Guard, you're a true patriot for Earth. Keep me posted. Constant communication. Night has completely fallen by the time we get back to the ranch. Everything looks just as we left it, calm and boring. Bernie, Sarah says, letting the dog out of the back seat. Go take a look around, okay? But be careful. I guess he understands her because he darts off as we hurry inside. I head straight to the back room to pack up my notes and computers while Sarah grabs some of our clothes, food, and other random stuff that might come in handy on the road. It's almost like we're getting ready to go on vacation instead of running away to hide from aliens and government henchmen. I've just pulled my big messenger bag over my shoulder when all the lights go dark. I hear glass breaking in the kitchen. Sarah! I shout. She yells back at me from the kitchen that she's fine. I trip over a chair trying to get to her. The windowless room is completely pitch black now that the power's off. I curse as I hit the ground hard, my left arm throbbing. There's a sound like the air conditioner starting up, and then suddenly the power's back on. I vaguely remember seeing a generator out at the back of the house. Thanks again, Guard.
As I get to my feet, I kick the chair out of the way. Just as I'm about to leave the room, the security monitors boot up. There are at least 20 Moogs closing in on the ranch house. There's a split second when I freeze, can't even will my legs to move. And then adrenaline crashes over me and I react. I grab two guns off the weapons shelves and bolt to the kitchen, where Sarah's crouched over a few glasses she knocked to the ground when the lights went out.
What was... she starts.
Moogs! I whisper.
Before she can respond, an explosion blows the front door in. Both of us duck behind the kitchen island. I'm about to tell Sarah to stay down when she grabs one of the handguns I brought from the back room and fires two shots through the kitchen window, nailing a Moog right in the forehead. It turns to ash and disappears.
Whoa.
Did you bring ammo? She asks as she fires through the front doorway while I cock the shotgun I grabbed.
Crap! Ammo!
No, I admit.
Can you use that?
She nods to my weapon.
Yeah?
Then cover me, she says. As gunfire and Moog blasts tear up the living room and kitchen, I pop up from my cover and start pumping rounds through the doorway and windows, firing at every possible place the Moogs could be. I wonder how screwed we are. How many Moogs were just off camera on the monitors? Sarah makes for the back room, grabbing a big butcher's knife out of a block along the way and keeping it positioned at chest level, ready to strike. I can't help but marvel at what a badass my ex-girlfriend has turned into. She reappears with a grocery bag overflowing with ammo. We duck behind the kitchen island again to regroup and reload. I keep my shotgun pointed at the kitchen window.
We could bunker down in the back, I say. The door's thick.
No way, she shakes her head.
We'd be trapped.
Then we have to make it to the truck. I pat my pocket to make sure my keys are there. They haven't blown it up or something. We nod to each other in agreement. The messed up thing is that we've been in this sort of situation together before, back at Paradise High. Only back on campus, we had superpowered aliens on our side. Now it's just us against a bunch of Moogs. But then, I tend to forget that I have friends who always seem to come through for me. There's a giant roar outside, like a damn dragon has suddenly appeared out of the sky.
Shit,
I say, imagining some kind of huge Moog creature that's going to tear the roof off the house at any second.
We're dead.
No, Sarah says as she reloads. Her face actually lights up.
We're saved.
Most of the Moog gunfire that had been focused on the house suddenly disappears. They're shooting at something else. The roar sounds again, but this time there's something almost familiar about it. Something I recognize. It's not unlike a beagle's howl.
Bernie fucking Kosar is destroying the Moogs in the front yard.
I grin. Can BK hold the bastards off? I ask.
For a little while, Sarah says. Probably.
Now, go! This is our chance! We move in unison, running in a crouched position until we're taking cover on opposite sides of the front doorway. Peeking out, I can see a bunch of piles of ash around the lawn, as well as at least a dozen shark faces attacking BK. I actually wasn't that far off when I thought there was a dragon in the yard. John Smith's dog is now a huge beast, all muscle and claws and snapping teeth. One of the Moogs blasts him in the leg with a cannon, and in response, BK impales him with one of two horns that have grown out of his head.
Holy hell, I mutter.
Go! Sarah shouts. BK will catch up! And so we run. Luckily, most of the Moogs are focused on BK, and the others we cross paths with are so distracted by the roaring of the beast and shouts of their fellow pale-faced douchebags that we catch them by surprise. A few shots and they're nothing but dust. We're in the truck quickly, and before any of them are the wiser, I've got the engine on and am gunning it down the little path that leads to the street. A lone Moog stands between us and the open gate to Yellowhammer Ranch. He holds a blaster out in front of him.
Get down!
I shout to Sarah as he fires. I swerve, losing control of the truck for a few seconds, but missing the blast from the Moog's weapon. I regain control just in time to ram into him. The alien rolls over the hood and roof, landing in the bed of my truck where he tries to get up on his feet again. Sarah leans out the window and shoots him, and I swear to God we really are the heroes in an action movie.
Bernie!
She shouts, her head still out the window.
In the rearview mirror, I can see Bernie's form start to change, and then suddenly he's soaring through the air as an oversized golden bird. He lets out a shrill call as his giant wings beat against the wind, propelling him forward. He lands in the back of the truck, returning to his familiar dog form just before he hits the bed. Half a second passes before his wet nose is against the back windshield. He barks and pants and looks like a worried, but totally normal, floppy-eared dog as we pass through the gate to Yellowhammer Ranch.
Holy crap, Sarah says. She's breathing deeply. Okay, we're okay.
Whoa. We don't know that for sure. I hand my burner over to Sarah. Text guard, tell him we just escaped the Moogs. It takes her a few seconds to get the text out because her hands are shaking a little. I keep my eyes scouring the road, the fields, and the sky, terrified that more Moogs are going to show up at any moment.
Okay, it's...
She starts, but she's cut off by the ringing phone. Guard is calling. Holy shit, is how I answer the phone. How far are you and Sarah from the house? Guard asks. His voice is the same, slightly distorted, electronic-sounding one from the night when he warned me about the FBI trap. I glance in the rearview mirror. I don't know, maybe a mile? I can still see it and... I'm cut off by the sound of an explosion. I hit the brakes out of sheer confusion and instinct, and so I can whip my head around and see it for myself. The ranch, the barn, the entire area surrounding our safe house has gone up in a huge ball of fire. I have to shield my eyes. That should take care of any Moogs remaining on the property and thoroughly wipe our tracks, guard says. Sarah turns to me, her mouth hanging open. Guard, dude, I say. Did you just blow up the safe house? My voice starts to get louder. Were we working on top of a bomb this whole damn time? I can guarantee that the only way that bomb was going to go off was if I wanted it to, and that would only happen in an instance like this. You were both perfectly safe. I don't know what to say. I just sit on the phone in silence, hardly breathing, trying to wrap my head around this. Get the truck moving again, guard says. The two of you are coming to my home base. Suddenly the GPS on my truck activates, plotting a course to some place outside of Atlanta. I'll see you in a few hours, guard says. Then he hangs up. Chapter 12. We pass a few other houses as we speed away from the ranch. They're secluded, just like Yellowhammer was, and separated by miles and miles of fields and land. All of them have little trails of smoke rising from their yards and roofs. Not completely destroyed like my base, but definitely messed up. The Moogs must have narrowed our location down to one area and then systematically searched for us house by house. My brain shuts down as I start to wonder who lived in these homes, who the Moogs slaughtered in their effort to find us. It takes everything I have not to puke my guts out. We ride in silence for a while, listening to BK's panting in the back seat. I think both of us are in shock. Finally, the quiet is broken when Sarah's phone rings. It's John.
Before you say anything, she says when she answers, I just want you to know that I'm okay.
She talks to John on the phone, and I strain to try to hear what he's saying on his end. She tells him a little bit about what's happened and where we're going. I'm glad she doesn't give him any specifics because I don't know how new her burner is or how careful John and the others have been about using them. Safe houses won't keep us alive, apparently. Paranoia might. Though I don't even know if I can call any of us paranoid, since our fears are totally justified. Tell John to kick some Moog ass, I say. When she's off the phone, I ask her how her alien boyfriend is.
Fine, she says. Are you worried about him? Every second.
We cross the state line into Georgia around dawn. Sarah yawns a lot, but doesn't sleep. I offer her an energy drink from my stash in the back seat, but she turns her nose up at it. I down a can in one gulp. Not long after that, my fever comes back, and I start to feel a little woozy. My arm is so sore that I can hardly use it to drive, and Sarah makes me pull off the highway and into a drugstore parking lot. She goes in with some cash and comes out a few minutes later, demanding I move to the passenger seat. I down a few Tylenol at Sarah's insistence, and despite the energy drink I've guzzled, I pass out. I wake up to Sarah poking the side of my face. We're almost there. The landscape looks eerily similar to what it did at the ranch house. Guard definitely has a knack for finding secluded hideouts. We come to a gate among a bunch of trees, and the GPS beeps that we've reached our destination. I can just make out a few structures through a dense thicket of incredibly green trees. Old signage says something about the place being a peach and pecan orchard. That must be the place. Guard's base. I can't believe I'm finally going to meet the man himself, I say as we start up an old trail that cuts through rows of thin, dead trees. I'm feeling groggy and drained, but knowing Guard must be just a couple of yards away fills me with adrenaline.
You sure this is where your friend is? Sarah asks.
I can hear the skepticism in her voice.
He's the one who inputted it into the GPS, I say. It just seems so ordinary.
I can see a few flashes of silver throughout the branches. Cameras. Naturally. I point them out to Sarah and tell her that I'd thought the same thing about the ranch house before I went inside. I'm guessing cameras are up all over the place, just like in Alabama. Possibly even some remote-operated weapons, too. I wouldn't put it past Guard. Eventually, the trees all give way to big open lawns around a white farmhouse and a gigantic steel building behind it that looks like it used to be some kind of small mill or factory or something. He's here, I say, more to myself than to Sarah. He has to be here. Everything is going to work out. We're going to meet up with Guard and figure out what we can do to bring down these Mogadorian bastards. I jump out of the truck when we park in front of the house, and I'm a little wobbly on my feet. My fever's getting worse. BK stares up at me with wet-looking eyes as if he's actually worried about me or something. But I man up and keep going. There's a note on the front door of the house that just says, "Out back," scrawled in messy handwriting. So we wander around the house to the big metal building. We walk through the front door and must trip some kind of invisible alarm, because suddenly the door locks behind us and there are four guns mounted on robotic arms trained on us.
Shit!
I yell as I try to pull the door open.
Mark, Sarah says quietly, but I can tell that she's freaking out.
I start to move forward, but the guns stay on me, keeping their aim with every step I take. So instead, I take a few steps to the right and plant myself in front of Sarah. At our feet, BK starts to growl. The edges of his body begin to contort, as if he's just about to transform into a monster.
I wouldn't go any farther than that if you don't want to end up full of holes, a muffled voice says.
There's a figure standing in front of us that's tall, taller than me, and wearing loose-fitting coveralls and a shiny robotic-looking helmet. Something about it is familiar, but I don't know why. My head is fuzzy from the fever. A bunch of tools hang from a belt around the person's waist, but I'm more concerned about what's in their hands, which, based on what I can remember about the weapons in my dad's old office, is a semi-automatic combat shotgun. Dozens of scenarios flash through my mind, none of which end well for us. My loudest thought screams that I've been duped again, that I've been a huge dumbass and somehow ended up communicating with another fake guard. Or maybe Guard was never on our side to begin with. There's no mystery grenade to save me this time, though. With all the security stuff everywhere, I'm guessing even if we did make it outside, we'd still be goners. Behind me, Sarah's breathing is heavy, and my entire body shudders with regret for bringing her into this.
I'm relieved when the figure lowers the shotgun, but that feeling is quickly replaced by confusion when the weird helmet comes off. The person in front of us is a black woman with strong, slightly masculine features. Her hair's shaved on the sides but fades into a short, flat mohawk on the top of her head. A sheen of sweat shines on her face. She looks like a badass warrior, but she's also totally hot. She stares at BK and mutters something in a language I've never heard. Her voice is commanding. Suddenly, BK heals. So much for that line of defense.
A chimera. Wonderful,
she says. She turns her attention to me. Mark James, you look even worse than the last time I saw you. That's when I realize why the helmet looked so familiar. I've seen this person before. In New Mexico. She's the courier who delivered the first package to me. Wait, I say. Your guard? She nods, raising one eyebrow as if she thinks I should have somehow figured this out already. As if I had any reason to guess that the person I'd been in contact with all this time wasn't a conspiracy-obsessed hacker shut-in, but a woman who looks like she'd be equally comfortable on a magazine cover or a battlefield. You can call me Lexa. That was my name on Lorien. Lorien? My head pounds as my brain tries to make sense of the fact that Guard is not only a chick, but an alien. What the hell is going on? Mark, Sarah says, breathless. Her eyes are wide and staring at something farther back in the giant metal building behind the woman. And then I see what's got her attention. Welcome to the hangar, Lexa says. It looks like we need to get you fixed up. I hope you're good with tools. I'm trying to get this thing to run off the primitive fuel systems available on this planet. She turns away from us and walks towards the beat-up silver spaceship, parked in the back of the hangar.
The Navigator. Chapter 1. I'm woken up by two pounding bangs that reverberate through my basement apartment. They're shouting somewhere outside on the street. A single thought shoots through my brain. They're here. My survival instincts take over. I jump out of bed and start shoving anything particularly damning out of sight, hiding data pads and electronic storage devices filled with stolen files in secret drawers and compartments I've built into my furniture. My heart pounds, but I move calmly, methodically, zoning in on my task. I've always worked best under pressure. It's a skill that comes in handy when you do what I do. I'm leaning over my main computer when a few notes from a guitar or synthesizer filter in from outside, followed by the sound of a cheering crowd. It's only then that my brain starts to logically assess what's going on. I pause to take stock of the situation, my fingers hovering over a keyboard, ready to wipe a hard drive full of incriminating data logs. There hasn't been any more banging or knocking. There's no official from the Lorien Defense Council bursting through my door. Just some music and the sounds of people laughing? It's only then I remember it's the day of the quartermoon celebration. The music riff stops. I pause and listen for a few seconds before closing my fingers into a fist and creeping over to one of the small windows located near the ceiling of my apartment. I step up on a chair and peel back a blackout curtain, just a hair, so I can peer outside. Across the street, Arlon Park is packed with people, its location on the outskirts of the city making it the perfect place for those living in more rural areas to congregate in celebration. A kaleidoscope of lights blinks over the dancing crowds, painting them in neon colors. Somewhere a stage must be set up. There are two more powerful bangs that once again rattle my apartment. A bass drum, I realize this time. Before a band breaks into some synth-heavy song to the obvious delight of everyone in the park. Part of me feels stupid for being scared by a drum, but mostly I'm angry. Not because my sleep was cut short. It's dark out, which means it was time for me to wake up anyway. But because this sort of government-sanctioned celebration is just one of the many ways that the elders keep the Lorik masses placated. They put on all-night parties and erect flashy monuments and light displays they call heralds, and we are supposed to thank them, to recognize these events as signs that all is well on Lorien. All is perfect. But it's not. My feet step back onto the cold stone floor. My heart is still pumping in my chest, and I try to slow it down by breathing deeply and stretching my limbs. The tips of my fingers drag across the ceiling as I stretch. On the streets of Capital City, on the rare occasions that I'm out in public during the day, I tower over most of the population, especially other women. Despite my height, I rarely feel claustrophobic in my apartment, which is just one big room. If I ever did feel cramped, I could just clean up a bit, since most surfaces are piled high with books and electronics in various states of repair or modification. I slip on black pants and a t-shirt before returning to my main computer. My adrenaline is still pumping. Best to put this energy to use. "Talk to me," I say, logging into my terminal. "What have you got for Lexa today?" I open up a few of the data collecting programs I've designed and find a treasure trove of intercepted messages, alerts, and intel. The most useful type of currency, information. A few weeks ago, the grid, which controls and monitors basically all communications and municipal functions in Capital City, had started to malfunction in various locations throughout my neighborhood. Usually, the grid is impossible to hack, even for someone as skilled as I am. But when my own scanners had alerted me to the issue, I saw an opportunity, a chance for me to gather confidential communications, to show the people of Lorien that there are pockets of corruption in our government and secrets that the elders and high-ranking officials keep from us. I was able to get to one of the grid workstations before the Muni's lackeys got around to fixing it. I did their job for them, adding a bit of my own hardware to the system. Since then, the impenetrable grid has been mine for the perusing. And I've been stockpiling all kinds of data. This is supposed to be one big happy utopia. At least that's what the elders, and therefore everyone who buys into them being all-powerful and all-knowing, want us to think. In order for Lorien to be perfect, all of us have to abide by certain rules. We fall into categories, which makes us easier to classify and control. Guard, Sepan. If you have legacies, you're a soldier. If you don't, you're a mentor or munis or bureaucrat. You're told to follow certain tracks, and if you don't, if something happens that sends your life careening off your destined path, or if you question the system too vocally, then the rest of the Lorik don't know what to do with you. If you aren't working in an expected role, you are flawed. You are different, which isn't a good thing. You might as well be actively working against the rest of the planet. Granted, that's exactly what I'm doing. Not for the sake of anarchy, but for freedom. What most people don't know or choose not to believe is that there are some of us who don't agree with the way things are run. We've realized that, while this may look like a model society, the cost is our free will. Some of us have lost too much to Lorien. I've lost too much, and I want to see it changed. We need reform. We need revolution. The sounds from the celebration across the street are so loud that my apartment has become an echo chamber of cheers and electronic music. I try to focus as I sort through the various communiques my programs have intercepted throughout the day. Mostly, they're harmless. Orders for Muni's workers. Notes from schools about absent students. Traffic statistics. What I'm interested in are the encrypted files. Those are the ones that get personal. You can tell a lot about people based on the words they don't want you to read. I've come across a lot of interesting tidbits. cheating spouses, conned business partners, less than scrupulous teachers at the Lorien Defense Academy. There are many people who would pay me well for the information, or to keep it from going public. I know because in desperate times, information has kept me fed and paid my rent. What I'm really looking for now, though, is something that will expose corruption in the Lorien Defense Council, or the Elders. Something that will force the people of Lorien to take a hard look at the way our government is run. I know it has to be there. I just haven't found anything heinous enough yet. But I will. I have to have faith in that. It's the goal that keeps me going, that gets me out of bed. Besides, I'm not just doing this for myself. I'm also doing it in his memory. I'm doing this for my brother. My apartment shakes. A little stream of dust filters down from the ceiling. There are some heavy fireworks being shot off elsewhere in the city. They're really going all out with the celebrations this year. An alert pops up that my decryption software is having trouble decoding a message that's just been intercepted from a communications channel I didn't know existed. I'm surprised my monitoring programs even picked it up. Either I'm getting much better at keeping tabs on Capital City, or the higher-ups are getting really sloppy. Whatever the case, an encrypted message broadcast on a hidden channel like this is bound to contain something important. I run a secondary decryption program, and an unintelligible mess of symbols and letters slowly begins to form words. While it runs, I try to figure out who sent the message and to whom. The former is a bust, leading me back to a computer terminal and address I don't recognize, though I log it so I can track it down later. I have better luck with the receivers. It appears to have been transmitted to only 9 ID bands, all belonging to people whose names I don't know. Not a problem. I run a cross-check against the LDC's database of every registered citizen, a database that could really use better firewalls. And sure enough, the names have one big thing in common. They're all Mentor Sapons. Curious. Why would 9 Mentor Sapons be contacted via an encrypted message during the Quartermoon celebration, a night when most people like to pretend they don't have a care in the world? I wonder if it's a matter concerning them or their guard. What unnecessary risks they're asking those gifted with legacies to take now. I switch back to the decryption program. It's still working, but I can pick out a few words. Airstrip. Guard. Loridas. My entire body freezes. Loridas. This has something to do with the Elders. I've been trying to track down more information about their current locations ever since I intercepted a grid message a few days ago mentioning they were all off-world. Why? What are they up to? I grin as I lean back, putting my hands behind my head and rubbing them over my buzz cut. Regardless of the message's content, something like this, something straight from the Elders, will definitely be valuable. People get obsessed over the details of the Elders' lives. I could have just intercepted Pittacus Lore's grocery list, and I bet I could sell it for enough credits to pay my rent for a month. There's a sound from across the room. My modified identity band, which looks more like a silver cuff now that I've integrated a communication system into it, vibrates on the table. Zophie's name flashes on the surface. I don't answer, but slip the cuff onto my wrist, wondering why she's contacting me. Possibly for another museum gig, I suppose. Zophie's from what others would call a good family, which really just means that they're wealthy and spend a lot of that money at charity galas and stuff like that. We were at the Lorien Defense Academy at the same time. Friendly, but not exactly friends. She was always with a pack of other students, but I preferred solitude. Even then, back before everything changed and I went off the grid. Later, years after the incident, we met again at a Kabarok in the Outer Territories, where I was reconfiguring a computer network. By that point, she was heading the Department of Otherworld Studies at the Lorik Museum of Exploration. She's the one who brought me back to Capital City to work on a restoration project at the museum, refurbishing the onboard systems of an old fossil fuel spacecraft. It was good money, enough to upgrade most of my computer equipment, which inevitably led to where I am now. But we haven't spoken at all since my last day at the museum, and that was a few years ago. Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe she just had too many ampules and wanted to wish everyone in her contacts a happy quarter moon. The sounds of the crowds crescendo across the street. I continue trying to ignore them as I crack open a can of liquid stimulants and take a seat in front of the computer again. More of the message has been decoded, but it still doesn't make a lot of sense. Something about a prophecy coming true, and the end of Lorien, and... evacuation? I mumble to myself. My ID band buzzes. It's Zophie again. I sigh, and am about to answer when I realize that the music from the celebration has stopped. The crowds are still noisy, but their shouts are morphing. They're no longer sounds of jubilation or celebration, but of fear and alarm. What the hell is going on out there? I rush over to the window and pull back the curtain. I can just see a bit of the sky. It's red. There's a surge in the panicked screams from the park, but since the small window is at ground level, the people sprinting past on the sidewalk mostly block my line of sight. My apartment shakes again, more violently this time. I see the light a few seconds before I realize what it is. Fire. Fire coming towards me in a huge wave, engulfing everyone in its path. Men, women, children. I manage to take a few steps away from the window before the glass breaks and half the ceiling falls down around me. Chapter 2. I come to, choking on smoke and dust. My ears ring. I can hear the sound of people yelling, but their voices are far away and fuzzy. At first, I can't even tell where I am. It seems like a small, unlit room thick with haze, until I recognize the arm of a sofa that's in flames a few feet away from me. I'm still in my apartment. Only the ceiling has mostly caved in, and there are smoldering planks of wood where my computer equipment used to be, and I'm half buried in debris. My first instinct is to try to collect some of my personal belongings, but I can't stop coughing, and my head is pounding, and I know that what I need to do is get up, out into some fresh air. It's too dangerous to stay here. And so I use the flaming couch as a point of reference and start towards the place where my window should be. I climb on all fours up a pile of rubble until I'm finally breathing in cleaner air and collapse on the lawn. My lungs are on fire. My dark skin is covered in ash and dust. It's only then that I realize most of my building has been blown away. The apartments above mine completely obliterated, razed, along with the rest of the structures on my block. I'm probably only alive at all because I was in a basement. Still coughing, I roll onto my stomach and look towards the park where the crowds had gathered for the celebration. Only, there isn't really a park anymore. The trees are gone. Small fires dot the charred grass, smoke spiraling up towards a crimson sky. There are scores of blackened clumps throughout the park, too. I tell myself they're tree stumps, or the remains of the stage I never saw. Anything to keep my mind away from the idea that these mounds were recently dancing around with their hands stretched up to the sky while drums and synthesizers blared. My stomach lurches. My mind races, trying to make sense of the world I've climbed up into, which seems so different from the one I was just living in. What's happened? What caused this? I wonder if there's been some kind of gross miscalculation of celebratory pyrotechnics, or if a guard's new power has overwhelmed him, turning an unsuspecting kid into an untamable inferno and wiping out an entire block. The streets fill with people, all shouting, adding to my confusion. They're singed and bloodied. Some huddle over unmoving bodies on the ground. Others stumble unevenly before collapsing. I realize that my identity band is vibrating. For all I know, it's been going off constantly since I woke up. It's Zophie again. Not knowing what else to do, I accept her call. Lexa! Her voice pours out of a hidden speaker on the side of the cuff. Hello? Are you there? Zophie, I murmur. My ears are ringing. You're okay. I thought you... Everything is so messed up. What's going on? I ask, getting to my feet. It's the first of a million questions that are threatening to pour out through my lips. My neighborhood. Island Park. Something's happened here. No, it's everywhere. We're being attacked. And not just the city. The planet. They're hitting us hard, Lexa. Their targets are strategic. I think Lorien is falling. Everything we'd been warned about, it's all coming true. The prophecy. My mind races back to the message I was decoding before everything turned to fire and ash. For generations, the elders have been warning us that one day Lorien would face destruction and death. Some kind of global calamity. It's the entire reasoning behind our society's setup, with our superpowered children trained to be soldiers against some unknown enemy. I'd always thought it was a scare tactic, but as I stumble forward, stepping past the remains of a man dressed in the colorful robes of the quarter moon celebration, I realize I might have been wrong. Lexa, Zophie continues before I can ask anything else. You have to come to the museum, right now. It's the only way you'll be safe. I need you. I have a plan. What? I ask. My brain isn't functioning on all cylinders. I'm not sure if it's shock, or the cave-in, or both. What are you talking about? Just meet me there. I'm on my way now. As fast as you can, Lex. Run. Don't let anything stop you. There's some kind of interference on her end of the line, and then the connection drops out. I look down at my cuff, thinking about who I should contact if the world really is going to shit. Who I should check in on. That's when I realize I have no one else to call. For the past few years, I've been alone, refusing to get too close to anybody, secluding myself, making sure I had no strings, no one tying me down. No one to worry or care about. I look to the sky. The smoke from my neighborhood has created a layer of smog far above me, all but obstructing the quarter moon and whatever else is out there causing this. Who is attacking Lorien? Why? How could... Beside me, the scarce remains of my building collapse farther, filling my basement apartment with fire and debris. I stumble away, coughing through the miasma of dust and ash that's kicked up. This stirs something in me. A switch is flipped, and before I know it, I'm running. On instinct. It's not until I'm at a full sprint that I realize my body is following Zophie's orders and that I'm headed towards the museum. My home is destroyed. My planet, flawed as it may be, is under attack. I don't know what else I'm supposed to do. I just have to focus and keep moving, heading towards the next goal. The chaos is everywhere, widespread. Most people I pass are preoccupied with their own survival or with trying to find or help out their loved ones. They yell, asking no one in particular what is happening. I hear a short screech somewhere to my right. Blocks away? Closer? Followed by an explosion and a rumbling beneath my feet that almost knocks me to the ground. Capital City is still under attack. And even after everything we did to prepare, we weren't ready. We were caught off guard. The museum. It's not that far away now. 10 blocks or so. I just have to keep my legs moving and concentrate on the sound of my feet hitting the ground and... Out of the smoke in front of me, charge half a dozen figures unlike anything I've ever seen. They're pale, dressed in black and carrying blasters and swords that seem to glow with a light of their own. Dark circles ring their black eyes. Their gaping mouths are full of sharp, jagged teeth. The one in the front is huge, taller than me, and three times as wide. He has a long black ponytail, but the sides of his head are shaved. Tattoos wind around his skull. These monsters are definitely not Lorik. I stop too fast, and in doing so trip over a smoking tree branch, hitting the pavement hard. I'm trying to catch the breath that's been knocked out of me when one of the men, no, creatures, raises a blaster and fires at a woman crying over a lifeless body on the other side of the street. She falls forward. My heart goes into overdrive as I fight the urge to vomit. I stifle a cry and half crawl to a nearby bush to try and get out of sight. The creatures continue forward. I look around to find something to protect myself with, but there's nothing. I'm alone. I don't even have a utility knife or anything with me, just the clothes on my back. I've always imagined there was no situation I couldn't handle by myself. I'm going to be proven wrong about this by being murdered on the streets of Capital City. I clench my fists. I won't go down without a fight, at least. Suddenly, a blinding light flashes through the square. I squint and reel back. The burst appears to completely disorient the creatures in black, who take the brunt of its force. And then the strange men are flying through the air, battering against each other and slamming repeatedly into the ground. Telekinesis. That means guard are here somewhere. The one who appears to be the leader is thrown far, well out of my range of sight. Another one of the sword-carrying bastards is impaled on a broken grid pole. He roars, and then his body starts to disintegrate, turning to dust. A girl who looks far too young to be facing such creatures darts past the pile of ash, one hand in front of her, as she uses her powers to crush another of the attackers. Her metallic red pants reflect the flames of a nearby club called the Pit, which smolders, threatening to live up to its name. Two other guard flank her, their arms outstretched as the bodies of their enemies crash against each other, eventually turning to dust as well. "This way!" the girl yells to them, flipping back her unnaturally white hair. "I see survivors in the distance!" She points forward, and there's another flash of light. Then they're gone. Whoever those guard were, I think they may have just saved my life.